to what the Edfu texts would call the time of the gods. Of course, this huge natural rock has been in this place, at the summit of a primeval mound, rather similar to the natural hill now enclosed within the Great Pyramid of Giza, for an incalculable period. But at some point, perhaps at the date in the 10th century BC that archaeologists accept for Solomon's temple, perhaps later, perhaps much earlier, it was modified by human beings, and there is now a hole cut through it which sheds a beam of light into the natural cave, also modified by human hands and evocatively known as the Well of Souls, that lies directly beneath it. I've been in the Well of Souls several times. If it doesn't have the raw atmospheric power of the subterranean chamber beneath the Great Pyramid, it's only because local bad taste has allowed the well to be tiled, carpeted, furnished, and lit as a prayer room. But the way the great rock that covers it has been cut and shaped is highly reminiscent of patterns that are found on rock-hewn surfaces at Giza. My guess, in short, as at Giza with its underground chamber beneath a natural hill, is that the rock and the well formed the original sacred shrine around which everything else on Jerusalem's Temple Mount was built. What came next was a platform, solidly founded, of gigantic stones to create the level, elevated surface upon which all later temples and mosques would be built. It is not my intention to explore the mysteries of Jerusalem here, but before moving on to Baalbek, the main focus of the present chapter, I will simply register surprise that the huge megalithic blocks which have been discovered in the so-called Hasmonean Tunnel, lying to the north of and directly extending the famous Wailing Wall, blocks weighing in some cases more than 500 tons, have been so readily assumed to be Herod's work. In the same way, the very similar gigantic megalithic blocks of Baalbek are assumed to be of relatively recent date, spanning the late 1st century BC to the second half of the 1st century AD, and to be the work of the Romans, with perhaps some early contribution by Herod himself. But just as the history of the Giza Plateau has been forced between narrow and restricting bounds, so too with Baalbek. Parts of it may be much older than presently believed. What led me to consider this possibility at all, indeed the entire reason I'm in Beirut in July 2014 and about to take a run over to the Bekaa Valley, Hezbollah, and the Syrian border, is the weird connection that I found linking Giza with ancient Canaan and with the ancient Semitic people known in the Bible as the Canaanites. The Magician Among the Gods. Selim Hassan, 1887 to 1961, was what a real Egyptologist should be. Passionate, erudite, deeply versed in his subject, and open-minded. He was also a hands-on excavator, and in the 1930s carried out the most thorough and detailed investigation of just about every major structure on the Giza Plateau. In the process, while excavating the Sphinx enclosure, he came across evidence of a Canaanite presence at Giza, indeed a long-term Canaanite settlement, which for some reason had been particularly focused on the Sphinx and its megalithic temples. How these people came to settle in Egypt, and why and when they left, we have not as yet any written inscription to tell us, Hassan admits. That they were there from at least the 18th dynasty, 1543 BC to 1292 BC, is well attested, but the possibility cannot be ruled out that their stay in Egypt dates back long before that time. At any rate, numerous votive stelae and other marks of respect to the Great Sphinx of Giza, inscribed and offered by members of this Canaanite community, have been found. We've seen already that the Sphinx was identified with the Egyptian god Horus, who could appear in many forms, but most often as a falcon. Of interest, then, is the fact that the Sphinx, in the Canaanite inscriptions, is called Hurna, and sometimes Horon. These are not Egyptian words at all, but instead are the names of a Canaanite falcon deity. The reader will also recall from chapter 10 that the ancient Egyptians often called the Sphinx Horemachet, Horus in the horizon. It turns out that this name is directly linked with Hurna in a number of inscriptions not only left by members of the Canaanite community that had settled near Giza, but also by the ancient Egyptians themselves. For example, a plaque of Amenhotep II, where the pharaoh is referred to as beloved of Hurna, Horemachet. Salim Hassan comments on the assimilation of the names Hurna and Horemachet in Amenhotep's plaque, which succinctly confirms the use of the name of the god Hurna in Egypt and its association with Horemachet and application to the Sphinx. Likewise, a stela found at Giza reads, "Adoration to Horemachet in his name Hurna. Thou art the only one who will exist till eternity, while all people die." And a second Giza stela represents Hurna in the form of a falcon, beside an inscription which reads, "O Hurna, Horemachet, may he give favor and love." Christiane Zivikosh, director of religious studies at the École Pratique des Hautes Études in Paris, adds that the variant Horon was also frequently used in the same way. Horon was so closely associated with Horemachet, name of the great Sphinx of Giza, that one addressed him indifferently as Horemachet, Horon, or Horon Horemachet. What really caught my attention, however, and put me on the plane to Beirut, was a further observation from Zivikosh. An epithet on a Sphinx statuette, she reported, indicates that Horon is originally from Lebanon. Intriguing, too, in light of the civilizing work of sages and magicians of which there are so many traces in the Edfu texts and in the Mesopotamian inscriptions, is a baked clay tablet from the ancient city of Ugarit on the Mediterranean coast of what is now Syria, a little to the north of Byblos in Lebanon. Horon is the subject of the tablet, and exactly like the Apkallu sages of Mesopotamia, he is portrayed as a conjurer. Indeed, notes Egyptologist Jacobus van Dijk, as the magician amongst the gods. With further echoes of the Apkallu, Horon's magic consists of what sounds to the modern ear like advanced scientific knowledge, in this case providing antivenom extracted from among the shrubs of the Tree of Death that cured the victim of a deadly snake bite. The poison was neutralized, we read, so that it became weak and flowed away like a stream. And there is something else, something that points directly towards Baalbek with its mysterious megaliths. For not only was Horon, Hurna, worshipped at Giza and assimilated to the Sphinx and to the falcon Horus, but Baal, the Canaanite deity after whom Baalbek is named, also had a cult in Egypt where he was associated with Set, the god of deserts and storms. Last but not least, there is the fact that Baalbek was renamed Heliopolis, Greek for City of the Sun, after Alexander the Great conquered the Levant and Syria in 332 BC. The reader will recall from chapter 11 that Innu, the sacred city of the ancient Egyptians where stood the Temple of the Phoenix, attended by the priesthood of Giza, was also called Heliopolis by the Greeks. They referred to it as such from at least the time of Herodotus in the 5th century BC, and the Romans followed suit. Likewise, Baalbek continued to be called Heliopolis throughout Roman times. Marching in Alexander's footsteps, Pompey annexed the Levant and Syria in 64 BC, and Roman power here reached its height in the 1st and 2nd centuries AD, when a statue of Jupiter, the most high and the most great of Heliopolis, stood in the courtyard of the great temple that the Romans built at Baalbek in honor of this god. As well as its usual Roman attributes, the statue, which may be seen today in the Louvre Museum in Paris, displays a winged sun disk on its chest. A possible reference, argues Friedrich Roget, formerly professor of architecture at the American University of Beirut, to the god of Egyptian Heliopolis. It was not until the Arab conquest in the 7th century AD that the original Canaanite name Baalbek began to reappear in Levantine annals, and it was only then that the city's Greco-Roman designation as Heliopolis fell entirely out of use. Between Lebanon and Anti-Lebanon Ranges. The morning after our late-night arrival in Beirut, Lebanese friends kindly join us at our hotel to drive us to Baalbek. Over coffee before we go, they tell us of our good fortune. There is a lull in the fighting in Syria. All is calm along the border, and they expect no trouble. Seen in daylight, the Lebanese capital is almost as charming and beautiful as it was at midnight. 120,000 people were killed in this country during the terrible and protracted civil war between 1975 and 1990. But the city, which was the focus of so much of the fighting, seems to have put that ghastly episode behind it. Most of the bullet holes, shrapnel and blast wounds in the buildings have been repaired. There's a lot of new construction going on, and the atmosphere is one of optimism and vigorous enterprise. Yes, there is sadness in the air. It's unavoidable after so much murder and mayhem. But the sense I get is of a nation recovering from its trauma, not wallowing in it, filled with bright, intelligent young people who are determined to move ahead. The traffic is heavy as we wind our way up the steep foothills of the Lebanon Mountains to the east of the capital. It's only 86 kilometers, about 53 miles, to Baalbek, but there are frequent military checkpoints where we're filtered through chicanes and inspected by attentive, heavily armed soldiers. Inevitably, this slows us down. The views, however, get more and more spectacular, with the Mediterranean gleaming behind us and the great green tree-strewn ridges of the Lebanon Range rising ahead of us. The road wraps itself around multiple tight hairpin bends above vertiginous drops. The air becomes notably cooler and the landscape more barren. Then we're over the top, through the Dahar al-Bedar Pass at an altitude of 1,556 meters, 5,100 feet, and motoring down the other side with the broad, intensively cultivated sweep of the Bekaa Valley opening out below us. We pass the edge of the urban sprawl of Zahle, famous for its Ksara winery, and pretty soon we're running through the Bekaa proper, although it is really a plateau rather than a valley, since its average elevation is more than 1,000 meters, 3,280 feet, above sea level. Bounded on the west by the Lebanon Mountains over which we've just driven, and on the east by the Anti-Lebanon Range, the Bekaa is watered by two historic rivers, the Litani and the Orontes. When the Romans colonized the region 2,000 years ago, this fertile plateau was one of their breadbaskets, exporting grain to feed the empire. Today, a more lucrative crop, though largely hidden from view, is cannabis. In the interests of keeping local farmers happy, the authorities generally turn a blind eye. After another 30 or 40 minutes of mainly level driving on a long, straight stretch of road with cultivated fields on either side, we enter the outskirts of Baalbek, at the edge of the Anti-Lebanon foothills. It's a shabby town of shops, offices, and dilapidated low-rise apartment blocks, many festooned with the Hezbollah flag, featuring an upraised arm at the end of which is a hand clenched into a fist around an AK-47 assault rifle. Hand, arm, and Kalashnikov emerge from a line of calligraphy spelling out Hezbollah's name, Party of God. Other lettering states, "Then surely the party of Allah are they that shall be triumphant," and separately, "The Islamic resistance in Lebanon." The background color of the flags is a strident yellow, while the logo and calligraphy are picked out in green. Fashions and preferences in gods come and go, but the sacred landscape endures. On an eminence above the town, we can clearly see the spectacular remains, the soaring columns, and the lofty pediments of the group of three Roman temples that bestowed such renown upon Baalbek in the ancient world. Dedicated, supposedly, to Jupiter, Bacchus, and Venus, they were built on a scale larger and more imposing than almost any other Roman structures, including those in Rome itself. What really interests me, however, is the megalithic wall that surrounds the Temple of Jupiter on three sides, and in particular the three gigantic blocks known as the Trilithon, that are embedded in it. Much that I've learnt about the Trilithon in my prior research has led me to suspect that it may be older, far older, and dedicated to a far more enigmatic purpose than anything the Romans built here. Now's my chance to find out. Centuries of darkness. The mid-morning sun is beating down out of an absolutely cloudless, clear blue sky, and I'm sitting on a big limestone block, roughly in the middle of what was once the Temple of Jupiter. I say once because there's very little of this towering edifice left standing now, other than the six immense columns that rear skywards about the width of a football field behind me. The last six, out of the total of 54, that originally demarcated the exterior of the vast rectangular structure. The site is so enormous, the complex of temples so colossal, and at the same time so ruined, that I'm finding it difficult to get my bearings. Also, I have to confess, the long echoing booms of distant artillery, punctuated by the rapid stuttering coughs of heavy machine guns, and an occasional very loud explosion, are a little disconcerting. Okay, I think, deliberately shutting my ears to the sounds that are, almost certainly, only the Lebanese military doing some practice firing. Let's figure out what we've got here. I glance over my shoulder, and when I do, I'm looking roughly southeast, through the six big columns which stand on the edge of the massive platform I'm in the midst of, across a sunken plaza, to the row of a dozen columns that line the northern perimeter of the smaller, but more intact and still very beautiful Temple of Bacchus, the Roman god of wine. I'm not here to research or write about Roman architecture, but still, I'm impressed. Not only did the Romans have the sense of fun to dedicate a temple to wine and all its pleasures, reportedly joyous acts of sexual license regularly took place within, but also, let's not beat around the bush here, these people really knew how to build. The columns themselves are extraordinary feats of megalithic architecture, and the Romans seem to have had no difficulty in hauling the ponderous blocks of the pediment, each weighing tens of tons, and in some cases hundreds of tons, up to the top of them. So let's be clear about this, right from the start, because there is so much ignorant baloney talked on the subject. The Romans were incredibly accomplished builders, and they were absolutely capable of moving and placing monstrously huge and heavy blocks of stone. If there's an argument to be made for a lost civilization at Baalbek, then it can't be based on block weights or on naive, ill-informed notions about what the Romans could or couldn't do, because in the realm of building, the evidence all around me confirms they could do pretty much anything they chose to. One of the things they frequently did was build their temples on pre-existing sacred sites. Their objective was not to obliterate the indigenous gods and religions, as the Spanish sought to do in Mexico, for example, when they installed churches on the site of Aztec temples, but rather to associate the gods and religion of Rome in a positive way with what had gone before. The pre-Roman cults usually continued to flourish, and the pre-Roman deities were honored and absorbed in a rich, creative, and endlessly proliferating syncretism. But for those doing archaeological forensic work to try to establish exactly who was responsible for what and when, this practice of overbuilding inevitably presents some challenges, particularly so, as is the case at Baalbek, when other later cultures and the ravages of time have also continuously modified the site. Towards the end of the Roman era, bad things began to happen here. The turning point was Rome's conversion under the Emperor Constantine, AD 306 to 337, to the new, fanatical, exclusivist religion of Christianity. The militants of that faith focused their beady eyes first on the Temple of Venus, described by the Christian chronicler Eusebius as a school to learn sensual practices, where initiates indulged in all kinds of debauchery. Constantine gave orders that the temple should be destroyed completely. In the event it wasn't. Julian the Apostate, AD 361 to 363, detested Christianity and reinstated the old gods, Then Theodosius, AD 379 to 395, took the throne, and the Christians were back in power with a vengeance. Constantine the Great contented himself with closing the temples, reports the Chronicon Paschale. But Theodosius destroyed them. He transformed into a Christian church the temple of Heliopolis, that of Baal Helios, the great sun Baal, the celebrated Trilithon. Some hundreds of years later, the Islamic era began. Around AD 664, Baalbek was besieged and captured by a Muslim army that converted the Temple of Jupiter and the Temple of Bacchus immediately south of it into a single large fortress. Various factions then held Baalbek and continued to fortify it. Indeed, to this day, it is often still referred to in Arabic as the Qala, meaning the fortress. In the process, of course, the ancient temples suffered further destruction. In AD 902, the Qamates, a dissident Shia sect, besieged and captured Baalbek, slaughtering the defenders. The Fatimites seized it in AD 969. 4 years later, a Muslim general named Zamathis arrived with a huge army, and another devastating siege and massacre followed. A Greek Christian army set Baalbek on fire in 996. By 1100, it was in the hands of the Seljuk, Taj Edola Tatush. In 1134, it was besieged by Zinki, who for 3 months hurled on its ramparts a storm of projectiles, using 14 catapults working day and night. In 1158, Baalbek was struck by an earthquake of unparalleled violence that destroyed the fortress and the temples. Nur-ed-Din, the son of Zinki, hastened to Baalbek to repair the damage which the earthquake had done to the ramparts. In 1171, a force of captured European crusaders who were being held prisoner in the fortress staged an uprising in which they slaughtered the garrison and took possession of the citadel, but were soon slaughtered in their turn by a Muslim army that broke in through an underground passage. In 1176, the crusaders were back. They attacked and pillaged Baalbek. Soon afterwards, in 1203, there was another massive earthquake that caused further extensive damage. In 1260, the Tatar Sultan Holako besieged Baalbek, captured it, and destroyed it. Not even the fortifications were spared, a folly that the Tatars came to regret when King Daher Bibars attacked them and expelled them. He gave orders that the fortress of Baalbek, which let us not forget was the site of the ancient temples, should immediately be rebuilt and its walls reconstructed. In 1318, however, nature took a hand again, and a fearsome flood undermined the ramparts, making several wide breaches. The water rushed in with such force that it lifted a tower 12 meters square to a distance of 400 meters. Next came the Turco-Mongol conqueror Timur. In 1491, after capturing the citadel and subduing all resistance there, he gave it up to the rapacity of his soldiers, who pillaged it ruthlessly. By 1516, when Baalbek became part of the Ottoman Empire, the fortress and its temples were completely ruined. In this state, they were seen by the English architect Robert Wood in 1751, whose detailed drawings of the site show 9 of the original 54 columns of the Temple of Jupiter still intact. Then in 1759, another fearsome earthquake struck, leaving only the 6 standing columns that I now sit in front of as I mull over the tumultuous history of this ancient sacred place. The question I'm asking myself is this: after so many cycles of construction, destruction, and rebuilding, how much can archaeology really claim to know about the site? As Michael Aloof, the former curator of Baalbek, confirms, "Unfortunately, this temple has suffered greatly through the ravages of time and the vandalism of the ignorant. Its walls have been demolished, its columns overthrown, and its foundations undermined. There only remain the 6 columns of the southern peristyle, 4 broken columns on their bases in the northern peristyle within the Arab fortifications, and the socles, plinths, of the peristyle of the facade. The Byzantine emperors were the first who began to destroy the temple, using the building material thus obtained for the construction of a basilica, The Arabs followed their example, extracting from the walls and the foundations of the temple any blocks of stone likely to be useful in fortifying the weak spots of the ramparts. Undoubtedly, the German Archaeological Institute, who have the concession for this site, as they have also for Göbekli Tepe in Turkey, are doing their best. In the process, however, they have revealed even more deeply confusing layers of complexity and have been obliged to overturn what was for a long while the mainstream consensus that the first builders at Baalbek were the Romans. Far from it. Indeed, under the place where I'm sitting now, which was in the midst of the area that once formed the cella, the inner chamber of the Temple of Jupiter, are the remains of a far more ancient sacred mound. Such mounds are known as tells in this region, and archaeologists now admit that Tell Baalbek goes back at least 10,000 years, in other words, 8,000 or more years before the Romans arrived here. A long sequence of Neolithic settlement layers, most probably the pre-pottery Neolithic, has been excavated, pushing the origins of Baalbek very close to the time when Göbekli Tepe flourished in nearby Turkey. Megalithic Wall North. The artillery fire is still going on in the background, but it's one of those noises you tune out after a while. I get up off the warm, comfortable block I've been sitting on and make my way a few dozen paces north, across what would have been the floor of the Temple of Jupiter, until I come to its northern edge, marked by a few broken columns, still upright on their plinths like the stubs of rotten teeth, set into a later, very makeshift and higgledy-piggledy Arab fortification wall. Into the wall, at intervals, are built embrasures with loopholes through which defenders fired arrows down on their attackers. Peering north through one of these loopholes, I can just see the top of a truly massive row of megaliths, perhaps, I'm guessing, 20 or 25 feet below me. I count 9 of them, and note that they're separated from the base of the wall in which the embrasure is set by a horizontal distance of another, rough guess, 35 feet. In the gap, which is overgrown with grass and bushes, are many fallen, broken blocks of stone. In order to get a better view of this strange megalithic wall, I continue to walk westwards, along the northern margin of the Temple of Jupiter, until I get to another part of the Arab fortifications that were later added onto it, the so-called Northwest Tower. I can step out onto this, there's a convenient terrace with a commanding view, and look back from it in an eastwards direction along the huge megaliths set out in a row below me and down into the overgrown, grassy gap that separates them from the wall of the temple platform. I'll not try to explain yet what those megaliths are. There are enough confusing factors already, but we'll return to them shortly when hopefully all will become clear. Meanwhile, I exit the Arab Tower, walk back into the huge rectangular space it leads off where the Temple of Jupiter once stood, and cross it heading east until I come to the steps that once led up to the temple's entrance. I descend the steps, then turn westwards again into the sunken plaza, bounded by the platform of the Temple of Jupiter to the north and by the Temple of Bacchus to the south. The Transmission of Knowledge. Naturally, I check out the Wine God's Sanctuary. It's beautiful, with a strong energy of its own, and I'm sure a lot of joy was celebrated here in antiquity. But there's a more serious side too, hinting that the Romans were the recipients of a stream of ancient knowledge and symbolism with its origins in the remotest antiquity. A stream, though divided into many channels, that continues to flow to this day. Freemasons who have studied the Temple of Bacchus point to a number of reliefs and designs here that are meaningful to them. For example, on the underside of a huge stone ceiling block, still balanced on the columns of the temple, appears the device known as the Seal of Solomon, a six-pointed star inscribed within a circle. According to leading U.S. Freemason Timothy Hogan, Grand Master of the Knights Templar Order, the figure in the center of the star is depicted giving a sign that would be familiar to entered apprentices. Another relief shows two figures sitting side by side and making gestures that would have meaning to a fellow craft in Freemasonry. It is also noteworthy at the Temple of Bacchus, indeed throughout Baalbek, how much evidence there is for the veneration of the god of wisdom, whom the Romans called Mercury, the Greek Hermes, whom the ancient Egyptians knew as Thoth and connected, as we saw in chapter 9, to the traditions of the seven sages. Another curious link is that the cult of Mercury, in its earliest forms, involved the use of betels, discussed in chapter 11, which were originally stones fallen from heaven, in other words, meteorites, and thus often part of the debris stream of fragmenting comets. When we recall that the black stone of the Kaaba in Mecca is said to be a meteorite, it's interesting that Baalbek in antiquity was the site of a famous oracle. The Roman Emperor Trajan reportedly held it in great esteem, and that it was a black stone which answered questions. Some scholars believe the Temple of Bacchus was jointly dedicated to Mercury. But since I'm not in Baalbek to explore Roman architecture, I won't describe it further. It's the Temple of Jupiter, and its tangled prehistoric past, that really interests me, particularly its relationship through the platform on which it stands with the earlier constructions, going back to the time of Göbekli Tepe. Again, sorting out the different phases is difficult, and I'm determined not to be lured by the trap that so many alternative historians have fallen into, namely to conclude, when we see huge megaliths, that super-advanced, even alien technologies must have been involved in moving them and lifting them. As I've already said, I don't dispute that the Romans could and did move enormous blocks of stone when they wanted to. Indeed, the evidence for that is all around me in the space between the Temple of Bacchus and the Temple of Jupiter, where heaps of carved and engraved blocks from the fallen pediments of both structures lie scattered. They are, without question, Roman. Some of them weigh in the range of 100 tons or more. One weighs 360 tons, and all of them were raised almost 70 feet, 21 meters above the ground, the height of the columns on which they were perched. I walk north through these ruins, back towards the Temple of Jupiter, looking up now at its 6 remaining giant columns, each one of them composed of 3 enormous blocks, and each standing on a monolithic stone plinth almost 9 feet, 2.7 meters high. You'd have to be a fool to argue that the Romans didn't make and raise up those columns, or the pediments above them, because it's completely obvious on stylistic grounds and on the basis of comprehensive archaeological research that they did. However, as noted earlier, the Romans were themselves both the inheritors and the transmitters of sometimes extremely archaic traditions, and it may not be an accident that the Temple of Jupiter originally boasted 54 columns. The reader will recall the phenomenon of precession discussed in chapters 10 and 11, and the mystery of precessional numbers encoded in ancient myths and traditions from all around the world, which Professors Giorgio de Santillana and Hertha von Deschen take as proof of advanced astronomical knowledge handed down from some as yet unidentified and almost unbelievable ancestor civilization. It so happens that 54 is one of the sequence of precessional numbers. It derives from 72, the number of years required for 1 degree of precessional motion. We then add 36, half of 72, to 72 itself to get 108, and divide 108 by 2 to get 54. In their groundbreaking study, Hamlet's Mill, Santillana and von Deschen point to the avenue of statues at Angkor in Cambodia, 108 per avenue, 54 on each side, as examples of deliberate precessional symbolism. So why not the 54 columns of the Temple of Jupiter at Baalbek as well? Megalithic Wall South. My eye tracks down from the top of the 6 remaining columns, past their huge plinths, to the wall of moderate quarter-ton blocks that they surmount, forming the southern edge of the Temple of Jupiter, and down again to the base of that wall, which in turn is flanked by a row of 9 colossal megaliths that are each about 32 feet long, 13 feet high, and 10 feet wide, 9.5 meters by 4 meters by 3 meters. These monster blocks weigh somewhere in the range of 400 tons each. A number of them, those furthest towards the west, have a nicely finished appearance, with the stone smoothed and polished and the upper half trimmed in to be narrower than the base. But others are rough, still showing the boss, the protective layer, that masons leave on the surface to protect the ashlar from damage while it's being transported to the site. The quarry these blocks were brought from has been identified. It's about 800 meters, half a mile to the south. I don't doubt that cutting and moving them would have been within the technical capacity of the Romans, the greatest and most ingenious builders of historical antiquity. Still, the question must be asked, are these blocks their work? Or someone else's? The question must be asked because the nine blocks I'm looking at now are part of the same stupendous megalithic wall to which belong the nine equally gigantic blocks I saw earlier on the north side of the complex. That northern row of megaliths and this southern row of megaliths form the northern and southern arms of a single gigantic U-shaped wall that surrounds the Temple of Jupiter to the north, south, and west, with the base of the U, in which is set the fabled trilithon that I've come here to see, oriented west. As usual with Baalbek, as though this were not complicated enough, there are further complications. These have been explored by Daniel Lohmann, an extremely thorough and really quite brilliant German architect and archaeologist, who has spent years excavating and closely examining this site, and who in February 2015 was gracious enough to engage in correspondence with me and to give me the benefit of his extensive knowledge. It's his opinion, which I'll go into in more depth in the next chapter, that the awe-inspiring U-shaped megalithic wall surrounding the Temple of Jupiter is 100% Roman. His case is that it was part of what was intended to become an immense podium. Let us follow the logic of his argument and call it Podium 2, with which whoever commissioned the temple, and since there are zero contemporary records, we don't know who that was, wished to surround his megalomaniac masterpiece. The upshot of Lohmann's investigation is that within the U-shaped wall of Podium 2, are the remains of what he sees as an earlier building phase, which he refers to as Podium 1. His investigations show the dimensions of Podium 1 to be 12 meters in height by 48 meters north to south by 95 meters east to west, but he admits the only certain clue to its age is that it predates the Julio-Claudian Temple, in other words, the Temple of Jupiter, which was built in the main by the Julio-Claudian dynasty spanning the reigns of the emperors Augustus, Tiberius, Caligula, Claudius, and Nero, 27 BC to AD 68. To cut a long story short, Lohmann argues that Podium 1 was the work of Herod the Great, the Roman client king who ruled Judea in the last decades of the 1st century BC. But there are no inscriptions or other documentary evidence that could settle the matter. So the only source of information is the well-preserved structure itself, notably, according to Lohmann, its stylistic features, such as the use of alternating rows of headers and stretchers, drafted margin masonry, and the reconstruction of the plan of this early structure. These elements reveal surprisingly close parallels to Herodian sanctuaries, and in particular the temple at Jerusalem, not only in general appearance, but in their precise proportions and measurements. These correspondences, Lohmann argues, between the two building projects strongly suggest Herodian involvement, even though its precise nature remains to be determined. As we've seen, the Jerusalem temple was destroyed by the Romans in AD 70, so Lohmann is obliged to base his argument on the only surviving part of the temple, the gigantic trapezoidal platform of the Haram es-Sharif. Nonetheless, the detailed comparisons he offers do indeed make an excellent case for Herodian involvement in Baalbek's Podium 1. What remains to be settled, however, is how extensive this involvement was. To be specific, although Lohmann concedes that Tel Baalbek was continuously inhabited since the pre-pottery Neolithic period, in other words, since the time of Göbekli Tepe, and although his whole argument is that the Julio-Claudian emperors worked around Podium 1 at Baalbek when they started to build the massive and imposing U-shaped wall for Podium 2, he doesn't consider the possibility that there might have been a Podium 0, which Herod in turn overbuilt. I can hardly blame him for that, since no mainstream archaeologist that I'm aware of is willing to consider the same possibility for Herod's restoration of the Jerusalem temple, particularly with reference to the huge megalithic blocks discussed earlier that now stand exposed by the Hasmonean tunnel. Nevertheless, it's a possibility that shouldn't be ignored at Baalbek, especially in the light of what Lohmann himself describes as the great antiquity of the site. And there's another possibility as well, which I intend to consider. It concerns the megalithic U-shaped wall that forms the base and boundary of the feature Lohmann calls Podium 2. Suppose that U-shaped wall isn't Roman at all. Suppose it was already in place before, not after, Herod built Podium 1. Suppose further that the tell that antedates Podium 1 by thousands of years was itself situated where it is because of the prior existence of the U-shaped megalithic wall. In other words, suppose the U-shaped wall, with its immense megaliths, was the very first work of architecture to be built on this site, perhaps enshrining some central feature, some primeval mound, in front of which the tell later evolved over thousands of years, until the Herodian temple was built on top of it, and then a little later overbuilt by the temple of Jupiter. Trilithon. Having climbed a stairway set against the side of a monstrously large block, the scale of everything here is truly epic, I make my way along the top of the row of 13-foot-high, 400-ton megaliths that form the southern elevation of the U-shaped megalithic wall that Lohmann sees as part of the never-completed Podium 2. I'm heading west now, and I pass under the six standing columns, which seem less to loom than to take flight over me. So light and graceful do they appear, despite their massive size. The wall they're perched on rises to about twice my height. Its upper edge, where the columns stand, marks the level of the floor of the Temple of Jupiter where I'd sat earlier. The space between the wall and the edge of the 10-foot-wide megaliths I'm walking on is an obstacle course of broken fragments of columns and ornate multi-ton chunks of the pediment they once supported. At the end of the long row of megaliths, I'm confronted by a warren of towers, archways, and tumble-down medieval Arab fortifications. I thread my way through these. It's all a bit bewildering. Climb a flight of stairs, and take a right turn into a narrow alley at the western edge of the whole complex. I'm heading north now. And the alley, which isn't wide enough for two people to pass abreast, runs between the outer fortification wall on my left, part Roman, part Arab reconstruction, and a row of rough-hewn megalithic blocks on my right. I don't know what to make of these blocks, but a few months later, in correspondence we eventually engage in, Lohmann will tell me that they're part of a filling layer that was intended to fill up space between the Herodian wall and the later megaliths which make up the exterior shell of the second Julio-Claudian podium. They were intended to be invisible behind the shell, so they remained undressed and with a rough surface. Whatever they are, these massive blocks are separated by little more than the width of my shoulders from the hybrid Roman wall extended by Arab fortifications to my left. The feeling is one of constriction, almost claustrophobia. After 20 paces or so, however, the alley widens as the outer fortification wall, previously several courses thick, suddenly reduces to a single course which, just ahead, has a large gap in it through which I peer down onto a grassy border some 35 or 40 feet below, edged by the modern fence that surrounds the whole of the Baalbek complex. That's when I realize for sure. I'd been half expecting it, but I wasn't certain until this moment. That I'm standing on what I've come to Baalbek to see. It's just over 64 feet long, more than 14 feet high, nearly 12 feet wide, and weighs more than 800 tons. It's the southernmost of the three famed megaliths of the Trilithon. Chapter 13. And then came the deluge. I'd hoped, I'd expected, I was almost sure, that the course I'd charted through the ruins would lead me to the Trilithon. but still I feel a minor sense of triumph that my wanderings in the labyrinth have actually brought me to this very special place. It's a good moment to take stock. That single course of outer fortification masonry to my west barely covers a quarter of the Trilithon's immense width. There's part of the drum of a fallen column lying just by the gap in the fortifications that overlooks the grassy border within the perimeter fence surrounding the ruins. Pressed against the fortification wall, this column covers approximately half the width of the huge megalith it rests on, the southernmost of the three in the Trilithon. All in all, this is a sheltered spot, a quiet space, a little courtyard almost. Conveniently, there's a loose block about the height of a stool for me to perch on, and what's more, since it's afternoon now, there's a patch of shade. With a sigh of relief, I sit down, haul out my notebook, and compose my thoughts. I'm aware, as I do so, that my feet are placed not only on the Trilithon block, but also on something inscribed into it that effectively proves it is older than the Temple of Jupiter, though not how much older. The shade is working against me. The 50 years since it was first brought to light have not been kind to it, and honestly, I can't see it. However, Professor Hartoun Kalayan, the engineer placed in charge of the restorations of Baalbek by the Lebanese Department of Antiquities, explains that back in the mid-1960s, in view of the scientific interest, Emir Maurice Chahab, Director General of the Antiquity Department, decided to have the top of the Trilithon cleared. When this was done, Kalyan explains, the south block exposed a full-scale orthographic drawing of the pediment of the Temple of Jupiter. The drawing partly extends under Roman construction, and partly it is hidden under an early period Arabic construction. This discovery suggests that the Trilithon was already in place to serve as a trestle board for the dimensioning and ordering of the pediment blocks. That is, in the beginning of the second half of the 1st century AD. Further, it can be concluded that after the construction of the pediment, after the drawing had served its purpose, the constructional scheme above the level of the Trilithon was executed. This is why part of the drawings extend under the Roman constructions. So right here at my feet, unfortunately invisible now without special lighting, is a convincing piece of evidence that a real mystery, not just one made up by alternative historians, surrounds the Trilithon. Obviously, since it was used for an architectural drawing of part of the Temple of Jupiter, as Kalyan admits, and particularly so since it was afterwards partially covered by Roman construction, the only logical deduction is that it must be older than the temple. We'll look further into the implications of this, but it should be noted right at the outset that Daniel Lohmann doesn't agree. Presenting a paper for the proceedings of the Third International Congress on Constructional History, held in the German city of Cottbus in May 2009, he argued, Kalyan suggested that this drawing proves the Trilithon to be older and already in place when the temple was built. Today, new indications show that this assumption is outdated and that the Trilithon and temple were built synchronous. The upper surface of this block, the southernmost Trilithon block with the drawing on it, was practically used for a simultaneous construction, later simply to be covered by the next stone course. And in a follow-up paper in 2010, Lohmann expanded on his reasoning. The unfinished pre-Roman sanctuary construction, Podium 1, was incorporated into a master plan of monumentalization. Apparently challenged by the already huge pre-Roman construction, the early imperial Jupiter sanctuary shows both an architectural megalomaniac design and construction technique in the first half of the 1st century AD. The most famous example may be the Trilithon, forming the middle layer of the Western Temple podium. The podium can be considered as an attempt to hide the older, inconveniently shaped temple terrace behind a podium in fashionable Roman manner. I understand Lohmann's logic, but I have a number of problems with it. First and foremost, there is the very concept of a podium that is being bandied around here. The dictionary defines podium as the masonry supporting a classical temple, or, alternatively, a stereobate for a classical temple, especially one with perpendicular sides. Asteriobate, in turn, is defined as the foundation or base upon which a building or the like is erected, or alternatively, the solid foundation forming the floor and substructure of a classical temple, crepidoma, podium. A crepidoma, likewise, is the platform on which the superstructure of the building is erected. What all these definitions hold in common is the notion that a podium is a structure on top of which a temple is built. But this is not the case with Lohmann's podium too. It is not the foundation or base upon which the temple of Jupiter is erected. It is not the solid foundation forming the floor of the temple of Jupiter. And it is not the masonry supporting the temple of Jupiter. What the temple of Jupiter in fact stands on and is supported by, as Lohmann himself makes clear, is the Herodian podium 1. Lohmann's podium 2, it turns out, does not support any part of the temple of Jupiter. It surrounds podium 1 on three sides, but it does not support it. It is, in other words, as I described it several times in chapter 12, a U-shaped megalithic wall, but it is not a podium. If the Romans built it as Lohmann believes, then they did not build it to serve any structural, load-bearing, podium-like purposes, but purely for cosmetic reasons, as an attempt, to repeat his own words, to hide the older, inconveniently shaped temple terrace behind a podium in fashionable Roman manner. In response, I can only repeat that podium continues to be a misleading term, which does not describe what we actually see on the ground. If Lohmann's analysis of the pre-existing Herodian works is right, then we don't see evidence of the Romans hiding the older, inconveniently shaped temple terrace behind a fashionable Roman podium. Whatever plans they may have had for extension and development, which we cannot know, and which there are no records of whatsoever, the evidence on the ground is limited to that massive, U-shaped enclosure wall surrounding podium 1 on three sides, but not supporting it. A profoundly megalithic wall, larger in every dimension than any other that the Romans are known to have built anywhere in the world. A wall that doesn't even look Roman, incorporating blocks weighing more than 800 tons, the trilithon, that would have required truly spectacular efforts to move and put into place. I'm not saying that the Romans weren't equal to such efforts, or that 800-ton blocks were beyond the limits of their building technology. I don't know, and don't claim to know, the limits of their technology. What I'm saying is that it is quite unlike the practical, phlegmatic cast of mind of the Romans, which Lohmann recognizes, to go to such extreme lengths for purely cosmetic purposes. Surely, therefore, there is room to consider an alternative possibility, namely that the megalithic U-shaped wall was already in place long before, perhaps even thousands of years before, Podium 1 was built. But in the very paper in which Kallian asserts that the trilithon predates the Temple of Jupiter, he goes on to give another crucial piece of information that seems to pour cold water on speculation of this sort. Yes, the trilithon is older than the superstructure of the Temple of Jupiter, but not much older, because a part of a drum of a column similar in dimensions to the columns of the Temple of Jupiter is used as a block in the foundation under the trilithon. In the absence, to our knowledge, of a second monument with similar dimensions of columns in Baalbek, one can conclude that the drum was a discarded one and that the columns were already cut or were in process of shaping when the foundations of the trilithon had started. Is this the ugly little fact that destroys a beautiful theory? Is my quest for a lost civilization at Baalbek fatally compromised by Kallian's column drum? Might I just as well pack up and go home? You would think so from the skeptical literature on this subject, which endlessly regurgitates the paragraph quoted above as though it settles the matter once and for all, as though it proves beyond reasonable doubt that the trilithon is the work of the Romans, as though any further thought and questioning on the matter is spurious, pseudo-scientific hogwash. Skeptical author and self-styled debunker of fringe science and revisionist history, Jason Colavito, for example, claims that archaeology and engineering can explain all the individual aspects of the Trilithon, and that there is therefore no need for an alternative perspective. Rather than do the work to back up this assertion himself, however, he refers us to the wonderful writings of another self-styled skeptic, physicist Aaron Adair. Adair, in turn, simply rehashes Cullion's arguments, placing heavy reliance on the column drum in the foundations and on the architectural drawing on top of the southernmost Trilithon block, to conclude, "We can be reasonably certain that the Trilithon stones were put into place contemporaneously with the construction of the Temple of Jupiter. So already, by having the Trilithon stones contemporaneous with the temple, we have established the Roman provenance of the structure." It all sounds reasonable, wholesome, and convincing. But actually, like so much else in the skeptical literature that is passed off as fact, it turns out, on close scrutiny, to be speculation, opinion, and bias masquerading as objectivity. That column drum that Cullion mentioned in passing, and that so many others have relied upon absolutely to reinforce established ideas about the chronology of the site, is much, much less than it seems. Ironically, the central problem that I'm coming to here is illustrated by Adair himself in a black and white photograph of the western wall of the sanctuary, apparently taken from a very old postcard, that he reproduces with his article to support his argument. Namely that there are blocks below the Trilithon, and that below these blocks, out of sight in the photo, is Cullion's column drum. But what the photograph shows in the wall above the Trilithon is a section of a different Roman column drum that was redeployed by the Arabs during one of the many occasions when we know they repaired Fortress Baalbek, after it had been attacked and pounded by enemy catapults. Moreover, as though to underline the impermanence of every redeployable feature in the walls of Baalbek, even that bit of column drum, which can also be seen in a photograph taken before the First World War and reproduced in 1980 by Friedrich Ruget, was removed in more recent restorations, as Santhafaya's images from 2014 in the plate sections show. Indeed, the Arabs regularly and routinely cannibalized, reused, and repurposed Roman column drums and parts of column drums. Moreover, as we saw in Chapter 12, and as Michael Aloof, a man who knew the ruins intimately for more than 50 years, confirms, the foundations of Baalbek were repeatedly undermined during the numerous sieges that the sanctuary suffered while it served as a fortress. After the sieges, the foundations were naturally repaired, otherwise whole sections of wall would have collapsed, and it is my view that this, rather than original Roman construction, is the most plausible explanation for the column drum found in the foundations beneath the Trilithon. Why, after all, if the Romans made these foundations, as the orthodox theory requires us to accept, would they have suddenly used a column drum at this point, when they would surely have had plenty of regular blocks, specifically cut and dressed for the purpose, at their disposal? It simply doesn't make sense. But Arab masons repairing an undermined foundation would have used whatever lay at hand, and the centuries of warfare, earthquakes, and other disasters that Baalbek suffered meant that there were enormous quantities of broken columns lying around, as there still are to this day. There is also another possibility, which is that the Romans did in fact put the column drum into the wall, but again as a repair rather than as an act of original construction. If the megalithic wall was already very ancient when the Romans came on the scene, and if it was their intention to use it as a base for further construction, they would undoubtedly have surveyed the foundations and repaired any sectors that the years had not been kind to. I scrawl, "Find out more about that column drum," across a page of my notebook. The matter isn't closed yet, one way or the other, but the hypothesis that the Romans were not the original builders of the U-shaped megalithic wall, of which the Trilithon is an integral part, continues to look viable to me, and worthy of further investigation. It's time to see the Trilithon from the outside. I leave my welcome patch of shade, poke around a little longer on top of the giant blocks, and then retrace my steps eastwards through the Temple of Jupiter complex. Eventually, It's a long walk. I find my way back to the main entrance of the site, pass through the propylaea and down the main stairs, turn right and follow the path that runs parallel to the southern exterior wall of the fortress the Arabs made of this place. The Temple of Venus comes into view a few hundred meters southeast of the main ruins. It's beautiful, but irrelevant to my purposes, so I ignore it and press on towards the southwest, passing two more Arab towers built into the fortification walls and eventually coming to a gateway in the fence through which I can see the trilithon in the distance.